This is Africa News Tonight on the Voice of America.
Hello and welcome. Welcome to VOA Africa. Thank you for joining us. I'm Yehayas Wuhib in Washington. Here's what's coming up on Africa News Tonight.
We are most definitely teetering towards a failed state. Remember that countries take a long time to die. Not only is our electricity unstable, unreliable, and unpredictable, the next crisis is water, and you can see it everywhere.
That's Professor Bonang Mohel, Chancellor of the University of Free State, on the challenges facing South Africa as the country's president gives his annual speech to Parliament. Details coming up. Also, authorities in Sudan have arrested a former cabinet minister. These stories and more on African News Tonight. We start with our top story. Journalists have been attacked and a radio station ransacked Wednesday in Guinea-Bissau, a week after an assault on the government compound where President Umaro Sissoco Embalo was conducting a cabinet meeting. The president described the incident at the time as an attempted coup that failed. I asked Alvaro Andredi, managing editor of VOA's Portuguese to Africa service, to brief us on the latest from Guinea-Bissau, starting with the attack on journalists and the ransacked radio station.
Yes, what you know is the radio is totally destroyed. 2 days after the attack by Radio Capital FM, 8 journalists and technicians were injured as they fled the scene. A journalist is in a critical situation and she must go to Portugal for medical treatment. The owner and director is out of the country. He is in Portugal and he has received that threat. The deputy director said today he has no idea when the radio will operate again, but now 31 professionals are unemployed.
Who's threatening this person?
The director of the Radio Capital FM, Lassana Kasama. Now he is in Portugal.
He's being threatened.
He's been threatened, yeah.
And received by government?
He has no idea. He has just anonymously calling. Maybe okay. If you return to Guinea-Bissau, you're going to be killed.
No.
Yeah. I spoke today with the deputy director, and he said no idea to how he's going to reset this radio station because it's completely destroyed. Just a reminder is in July 2020, the radio was destroyed too by gunmen. Yesterday, the house of a well-known political commentator was shot. He also is a Radio Capital FM analyst. Now he's heading in the religious organization in Bissau, or in the interior of the country. We have no idea, but now we know he fled his house yesterday. Also yesterday, a lawyer who participates in the radio show also fled his home after being told he was being pursued by gunmen. Today, the government spokesman, Fernando Vaz, told journalists that the government condemned the radio attack and the attack of the commentator's house, and the government asked the police to investigate and bring the authors to the justice.
Yeah, the station, like you mentioned, is Radio Capital
FM,
and it's very critical of Umaro Sissoco Embalo's government. And like in talk shows, for instance, people actually call the station to ask questions or questioning the official version of the February 1st attack. They say it was an act taken to justify the crackdown on the opposition. So how do you tie this all up with the radio?
It's true. It's a critical radio, and he has open mic shows, and the people call from different parts of Guinea-Bissau. It's a radio. This radio is a great radio station. They listened to Radio Capital FM in the whole country, and the people, the listener called from different parts of the Guinea-Bissau and criticized a lot the government.
Should we give any credence to the point where they're saying this whole thing, the coup, the attempted coup last week was staged? That's the kind of feeling wire services are reporting right now.
Yeah, a lot of people says the is not a failed attempted coup. It's a tentative of attempted coup from the government. It's not. They have no. We have no information. The real information about this is just what the people said, calling to Radio Capital in the you know, what I have information is the government doesn't speak a lot with that radio station, and it looked like is the radio maybe pro the main party, the PAIGC, but it's very important to say this is this attack was at 10 p.m. after one of these critical show.
Alvaro Andrade, my managing editor from VOA's Portuguese to Africa service. Thank you for your input.
My pleasure.
Al-Shabaab, an Al-Qaeda affiliate based in Somalia, has carried out 4 suicide bombings since January 1st, equaling the number of similar attacks in the prior 4 months. U.S. Africa Command Commander General Stephen Townsend says it remains Al-Qaeda's largest, wealthiest, and most active arm. Emily Estelle, research manager at the American Enterprise Institute's Critical Threats Project, discussed with VOA senior analyst Mohammed El-Shenawi how Al-Shabaab used the country's ongoing political crisis to strengthen its posture.
Al-Shabaab capitalizes on political crises in Somalia to make different kinds of gains, so military, economic, and rhetorical or ideological. So some of these changes are really concrete. Like during the last round of major political unrest in April 2021, Shabaab increased its control over roads in north central Somalia while security forces were occupied with the political crisis. More recently, and during the kind of most recent round of this crisis, Shabaab has been surging its bombing campaign in the capital to try and make things worse and exacerbate tensions, basically. And the group has also escalated its assassination campaign, targeting officials and officers in Mogadishu. Now, the ongoing political instability allows Shabaab to keep up its extortion, taxation, money-making ventures. And it also creates a rhetorical opportunity for Al-Shabaab to present itself as an alternative to the Somali government. So saying that it's targeting security forces because they are corrupt or ineffective, or targeting foreign forces in order to present itself as defending the Somali homeland.
As the political crisis in Somalia continues, what are the possible scenarios and how would Al-Shabaab exploit each one of them to expand its reach?
So there's a range of potential political outcomes here. And so I assess that the most likely will still be some sort of political deal, though probably with a fair bit of instability along the way. And we're seeing kind of competitions for control of different Somali states right now. So in the short term, I expect, you know, any fighting between different kind of rival government groups to lead to Al-Shabaab being able to advance in different parts of the country, similar to what we saw in April. And for example, right now in the Hirshabelle state, there is a kind of both a political crisis going on and an uptick in Al-Shabaab activity in different parts of that region. Now, in a worst case scenario, though, where you see the political crisis really get out of hand and verge kind of into a civil war, that would be a case where Shabaab would be able to make much more significant gains. So rather than kind of preserving what it has and advancing on some of its efforts, you could see a, you know, significant expansion. So what that would look like would be, you know, enough chaos created that Shabaab can try and return to some of the major cities, whereas right now it's kind of mostly confined to the countryside in Somalia. So that would be one way that a different political outcome, and a less likely one still in this case, could lead to major gains for Shabaab.
U.S. Africa Command Commander General Stephen Townsend said Al-Shabaab remains Al-Qaeda's largest, wealthiest, and most active arm, and that Al-Shabaab is actively pursuing transnational terror capabilities alongside its goals in Somalia. How would Al-Shabaab achieve such a goal?
So Shabaab has used its kind of local base and its ability to kind of have a secure haven and make money to support its ambitions to develop a transnational terror attack capability over time. So this is a goal that Shabaab leadership has professed for pretty much its entire existence. But what's happened over the last couple of years is that we've started to see evidence that they're actually kind of actively pursuing plots. So first, you know, the availability of funding. Some research has been done on Al-Shabaab's revenues, and they're kind of almost the same as the Somali federal government's revenues. When the group is controlling population and has kind of infiltrated the economy in many ways, it can access resources. Now, one way it's been using these resources is develop various capabilities. So in 2016, there was a Shabaab attempt to bomb a plane leaving Mogadishu. So that was a new explosive capability. There have been a few smaller changes like that. And then more recently, also on the topic of aviation, Al-Shabaab members were in pilot training and were tasked with plotting a 9/11 style attack on the US. And so that plot was, of course, disrupted. But it's another indicator of where Al-Shabaab is putting some of its resources and trying to not just develop the ability, but also try and start executing those kinds of transnational terror plots.
That was Emily Estelle, Research Manager at the American Enterprise Institute's Critical Threats Project, speaking with my colleague, Mohammed Al-Shenawi. After 2 years of struggling to contain the deadly spread of COVID-19, the World Health Organization reports the African continent is poised to control the trajectory of the pandemic. Lisa Schlein reports from Geneva.
The first case of COVID-19 was detected in Africa on February 14, 2020. Since then, more than 11 million people have been infected on the continent, and more than 242,000 have died. The World Health Organization Regional Director for Africa, Matshidiso Moeti, says the pandemic has taken a toll in terms of lives lost and the incalculable damage done to African economies. Despite all this, she says the African people have battled and survived four waves and several variants of the infection. During this trying period, she says Africa has become smarter, faster, and better at responding to each new surge in COVID-19 cases.
As we stand here today, we're finally able to say that if the current trends hold, there is light at the end of the tunnel. As long as we remain vigilant and we act intensively, particularly on vaccination, the continent is on track for controlling the pandemic. It's been an extremely difficult 2 years, but against all odds, Africa is weathering this terrible storm.
Africa has made great progress over the past 2 years in managing COVID-19 cases. WHO reports the number of intensive care unit beds and oxygen production plants has increased. The UN Health Agency also has increased the number of laboratories able to detect COVID-19 from 2 to more than 900 today. Despite these and other improvements, Moeti says vaccination remains the best defense against this deadly disease. She also notes African countries continue to lag behind other countries in inoculating their populations.
While many countries are considering booster shots, 85% of Africans have yet to receive a single shot. To reach the levels of immunity achieved in other parts of the world, vaccine uptake needs to be significantly accelerated across the region and urgently.
Moeti says a steady supply of doses is now reaching Africa, but is not enough to change the situation for the better. Getting those life-saving shots into people's arms, she says, requires faster and more effective vaccine rollouts. Lisa Schlein for VOA News, Geneva.
Authorities in Sudan arrested former cabinet minister Khalid Omar Yusuf and members of the Forces of Freedom and Change Coalition at a meeting last night. A member of the political bureau of the Sudanese Congress Party confirms Yusuf was arrested and is being held at Soba prison. Authorities have not disclosed the reason for his arrest. Yusuf was among the dozens of civilian political leaders detained immediately after Sudan's October 25th military coup. Weeks later, they were released under a political agreement rejected by protesters. Some foreign diplomatic missions in Sudan have expressed concerns over the incident, saying such incidents undermine efforts to resolve Sudan's political crisis. Cameroonian health authorities say at least 1,300 cholera cases have been detected and 32 have died from an outbreak in the past 2 weeks. Cameroon's public health ministry says water shortages and poor hygiene have spread the bacterial disease to half the country's 10 regions. Mokedun Kinteka reports from Yaounde.
Cameroon says the lives of thousands of its citizens are at risk. Manauda Malashi, the state minister of public health, said five of the country's 10 regions have been affected by an ongoing cholera outbreak in a press release signed on Wednesday. The statement says Bakassi, a southwestern peninsula near the Nigerian border, Cameroon's commercial hub and coastal city Douala, and Cameroon's capital Yaounde are the worst hit by the outbreak. Other towns affected are Boya, Tiko and Motengene, southwestern commercial towns, and Marwa and Garwa on the northern border with Nigeria. Kelvin Fosson, a community team worker, said he was sent from Boya to Motengene this week to help civilians affected by the outbreak. He spoke via a messaging app from Motengene.
Since the outbreak, we have engaged ourselves into community sensitization. Most especially the quarters where death were recorded, we have been there visiting homes, disinfecting toilets, public taps, and water points. We teach them how to take care of their environment with the help of some doctors.
Cameroon's public health minister says 32 of the 1,300 people affected by the outbreak have died within 2 weeks, and adds that the figures may be higher. The government reports that about 70% of the country's 26 million people visit African traditional healers and go to hospitals only when their health conditions get worse. The government says it is difficult to gather statistics from African traditional healers in the country's towns and villages. Linda Esso is the director of epidemics and pandemics at Cameroon's public health ministry. ESO says after the first cases were reported, the government started telling people to go to the nearest hospitals if they experience watery diarrhea, vomiting, or dehydration. She says civilians should follow basic hygiene practices such as washing their hands with soap and using and cleaning latrines after defecation. ESO warned against eating uncooked raw food and unwashed fruits or drinking water that is not boiled. She said keeping latrines dirty increases the risk of cholera. Mathias Ngun is the most senior government health official in Boya, an English-speaking southwestern town, where 30 cholera cases have been reported, with 3 deaths. Ngun says the lack of clean drinking water is exacerbating the spread of cholera in Boya. He says he has informed the government that the provision of water is an emergency need.
We went to all the houses of suspected cases and we disinfected them. And also we have had a coordination meeting with the administrative authority to respond to the outbreak.
The central government in Yaounde said it will provide clean drinking water to arid towns and villages in Cameroon, but did not say when. The government is encouraging civilians to boil water from wells and streams before drinking it. Cameroon said a cholera outbreak in November claimed 13 lives and affected several hundred people as it prepared to host the African Football Cup of Nations, or AFCON. Cameroon hosted AFCON from January 9 to February 6. The government promised to stop its spread before the continental football event that brought several thousand football fans, players and match officials here. Moki Edwin Kinzeka for VOA News, Yaounde, Cameroon.
South Africa's President Cyril Ramaphosa gives his annual State of the Nation speech in Parliament today. He's addressing a country in crisis on multiple fronts. Joblessness and crime continue to soar, exacerbated by the COVID-19 pandemic, the worst in Africa. Analysts say Ramaphosa's party, the ruling African National Congress, driven by infighting and corruption, is typical of South Africa today. Darren Taylor reports.
Professor Bonang Mohale says he doesn't know what the president's going to say to South Africa, but he knows what he won't say.
we now hold the world record for all the wrong things. The most unequal society in the world, the country with the highest unemployment rate in the world, the country with the highest SME failure rate in the world. We are now second only to Russia in terms of the suicide rate.
Mahale is Chancellor of the University of Free State and also leads Business Unity SA. It represents most top national and international private companies in the country. Mahale is usually very measured in his commentary, but as he reflects on what he says is the true state of the nation, he says the diplomat inside him is dead.
We are most definitely teetering towards a failed state. Remember that countries take a long time to die. Not only is our electricity unstable, unreliable, and unpredictable, the next crisis is water, and you can see it everywhere.
The corruption of the Jacob Zuma presidency has almost bankrupted South Africa's national power company, Eskom. Not maintaining equipment means the country's lights are often off. ANC municipalities are also torn by graft and mismanagement, with many not providing essential services such as water. Mahale says government failure is everywhere, even in its own backyard.
We saw Parliament burning down purely and simply because a 2017 fire report that says these are the things that need to be remediated have not been done.
Then he says there's the example of the health minister who goes to a hospital to check on its vaccine rollout and finds the facility in such a bad state that he orders its immediate evacuation and closure. Mahale says a clear sign of a failed state is the inability of a government to maintain law and order. He says the South African Police Service, the SAPS, is at the mercy of criminals.
At any point in time, 21 men would jump off a van with semi-automatic weapons to extort money from businesses. And what is our government doing? What is the SAPS doing? They are folding their arms and doing absolutely nothing.
International crime monitoring groups say high violence crimes, including murder, armed robbery, and rape, make South Africa the third most dangerous country on earth, outside of war zones. Mahale says the government's good only at making false promises, collecting taxes, and then pocketing the money.
You're not happy with just drinking from the tap in terms of stealing. Now you go directly to the national treasury. You want to really drink from the fire hose. Industrial scale looting, I'm talking about. That's where we are as a people, as a country with great natural endowment.
He points out that 10 million South Africans who should be working don't have jobs.
75% youth unemployment when young children of military age are sitting at home twiddling their thumbs. Not only are we asking for trouble, we are actively inviting it. Very soon we'll be talking about the redistribution of poverty, not wealth.
The ANC says South Africa has problems, but is nowhere near being a failed state. But for Mahale and many others, all the signs are there. For VOA News, I'm Darren Taylor in Johannesburg.
And that wraps up this edition of Africa News Tonight. I'm Yeheyes Wuhib in Washington. For all the latest developments on the continent 24/7, visit our website at voanews.com. On behalf of our producer, Mokbilia Baro, thank you again for tuning in and choosing the Voice of America.